VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to Crosstalk here on VCY America. First of all, a reminder, today is Super Tuesday. A number of states casting ballots today. So let me give a reminder to those of you listening in Arkansas and California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, and American Samoa to exercise the stewardship that you've been given of your vote. We encourage you to be informed and to vote prayerfully. Also, of special note, just breaking news moments ago, Arizona listeners, you'll have special interest in this. U.S. Senator Kyrsten Sinema announced she will not be seeking re-election this fall. Arizona then will be having an open Senate seat for the United States Senate. Friends, regardless of where you are, please be in prayer regularly for the elections taking place, not only during the primary time, but also, of course, as we await the November elections as well. Well, yesterday on Crosstalk, we began sharing with you the audio from a roundtable discussion that was hosted by Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. The roundtable was held at the U.S. Capitol February 26, 2024, just last week. It was titled Federal Health Agencies and the COVID Cartel, What Are They Hiding? And in this discussion, the senator and a panel of experts exposed the corruption and, yes, the censorship of the COVID cartel, including federal health agencies, Big Pharma, legacy media, and big tech. The event opens the public eyes to the failure of the global elite and their institutions. So this is a forum that was designed to give a voice to those whose voices have been suppressed or have been marginalized. Yesterday's program, we heard testimony from Senator Ron Johnson, Dr. Robert Malone, Dr. Jessica Rose, and Ed Dowd. Ed was our last featured speaker yesterday with Finance Technologies and spoke to the 1.1 million excess deaths. 1.1 million excess deaths. This is all with the rollout of the COVID shot. 3.5 million excess disabilities and lost work of $135 billion. By the way, you can go back and listen to yesterday's program at crosstalkamerica.com, crosstalkamerica.com. If you want the full roundtable, you can find links at Senator Ron Johnson's website. Go to senate.gov and look for Senator Ron Johnson. You'll see that with his news releases there. But today we're going to continue airing from this roundtable. Matter of fact, both today and tomorrow we're going to do this. We're not going to be able to air the full four-hour roundtable, but certainly give you a sense of what is being exposed that the legacy media and big tech and big pharma and federal health agencies are trying to silence and to deplatform such messages. And the information, though there were some media present, I'm sure you have not seen this on your nightly news. You may have heard a reference to a roundtable, if that at best. So today and tomorrow, we're going to continue to listen to more of the testimony that was presented. So today we're going to be hearing from Kevin McKiernan, Dr. David Gortler, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Barbara Lowe Fisher, perhaps another participant as well. So let's continue with that roundtable discussion from Senator Ron Johnson, federal health agencies and the COVID cartel. What are they hiding?
Next participant is Mr. Kevin McKiernan. Mr. McKiernan is a former team leader of research and development for the Human Genome Project at Whitehead Institute / MIT. He is an inventor of the solid sequencer, founder of Agincourt Biosciences and Medicinal Genomics, and he has 60,000 citations and dozens of genomic patents. Mr. McKiernan.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Very much appreciate you giving us this audience. Many in this audience have been subjected to years of censorship on this topic. What I want to talk to you today is about the DNA contamination that our team at Medicinal Genomics discovered in the mRNA vaccines. We're specifically speaking about Pfizer and Moderna in this case. This work has been replicated by many labs around the world, and now the FDA, the EMA, and even Health Canada have admitted to this. The regulatory agents have admitted that Pfizer also omitted the SV40 sequences that are in their vaccine. They've deemed this contamination to be of little consequence, claiming the DNA is of too little concentration to matter or to be containing DNA of no functional consequence. These statements are false and are not supported by any independent testing by these regulators. After the regulators have admitted to being deceived, they ask the opinion of the party that deceived them, how bad was the deception? They shockingly believe the answer they were given, which is that these sequences have no relevance to plasmid manufacturing. As someone who has worked on the Human Genome Project manufacturing millions of plasmids, I can assure you that this is an overt lie. DNA contamination can lead to insertional mutagenesis. This is actually declared in Moderna's own patents regarding mRNA vaccines. This is U.S. patent 10,898,574. This is also supported by Lim et al., which speaks to the rate of spontaneous integration in the genome during transfection. We are using transfection, after all, with LNPs. The SV40 DNA is, in fact, functional. It is published as a potent gene therapy tool in a nuclear targeting sequence, as described by David Dean et al. The SV40 promoter DNA is also known to bind to the tumor suppressor gene known as P53. This is described by Draiman et al. The DNA contains the promoter for the antibiotic resistance gene in this plasmid as well. No plasmid manufacturing can occur without a promoter for the antibiotic resistance gene, so it is clearly functional and key to plasmid manufacturing despite the FDA's comments on this topic. The DNA quantity in many vials is over the 10 nanogram per dose limit, but it does vary substantially between lots. When we use both qPCR and fluorometry, these two tools give us different answers. This should be a concern that they're allowed to cherry pick between these different tools. Moderna's own patents, U.S. patent 10,077,439, teaches that qPCR underestimates the quantity of this contamination, and the DNA regulators are once again allowing them to cherry pick between these different measurement tools. DNA guidelines used to be 1,000-fold lower before the NCBI Act was established, which provided liability protection for pharmaceutical companies. The limits were devised based on the 10-minute half-life of DNA in the blood, naked DNA in the blood. This DNA contamination is not naked. It's protected in lipid nanoparticles, which delivers this DNA to cells, which should arguably have limits set to the ones prior to the NCBIA. We have since found Pfizer lots 1F1042A that are at least tenfold over any lot we've measured before with qPCR, which is known to underestimate this quantity. For those not familiar with PCR, you may have received CT scores of 35 that called you positive for COVID. We're seeing CT scores of 13 on the DNA that you're injecting into children. We've applied these vaccines to some cancer cell lines and have evidence that it enters the cell and can survive several cell divisions. We have preliminary evidence, although this requires replication in other labs, that this DNA can integrate into the genome. We found two spike sequence integration events in ovarian cancer cell lines of CAR3 into chromosome 12 and 19 very recently. Since these vaccines were expected to only contain mRNA, they were never assessed for genotoxicity studies. These studies are therefore being conducted as guinea-pigged U.S. citizens, as we witnessed an unprecedented rise in cancer drug sales since the vaccines rolled out. In summary, the vaccine manufacturer's own patents teach that the methods being used to monitor this DNA are not fit for purpose. Their patents teach the insertional mutagenesis risks present in LNP-based mRNA vaccines. The only people who are in denial of these facts are the regulators who are routinely hired to work for these very pharmaceutical companies. Two of these regulators resigned over the wanton approval of these vaccines for young patients who do not benefit from them. It is time for our representatives to repeal or review the PDUFA Act of 1992. This act allows regulators to defray the costs of regulation by accepting payments directly from the companies they regulate. Over half of the FDA's budget is sourced through this act. They cannot be voted into office, they cannot be voted out, but they can approve dangerous, liability-free, mandated vaccines. These policies have harmed the public, torn our country apart, as immune nurses are forced to choose between their jobs and useless and even dangerous vaccines. DNA contamination was not part of any informed consent process, and many universities still mandate these shots based on the guidance and approval of our regulators who have become nothing less than a marketing division of the companies they regulate. Thank you for the time.
So, Mr. McKiernan, in layman's terms, what is the danger of this DNA contamination? I know fact checkers said it can't get in the cell, can't get in the nucleus. Address that for us, if you would.
So, yes, the fact checkers have been continually wrong throughout the last year this has gone on. They initially claimed this could not get into the cells. First, they claimed it wasn't there. Now the FDA and the regulators have admitted it's, in fact, there. Then they claimed it wouldn't get into the cells. We've now shown that, in fact, that is the case. As expected, anything that's inside of a lipid nanoparticle, one would expect to get into a cell. Now that we're starting to see early signs of DNA integration, you know, the DNA alone may not be the cause of cancer. I think it may be a contributor. Usually cancer requires a multiple hit hypothesis. You need to have weakened immune systems like lymphocytopenia, which these shots do deliver. You might need some suppression from P53 or BRCA1, which there are publications showing that the spike protein suppresses those genes. And if you added an increased mutagenesis rate, well, all three of those things can create a perfect storm that may be driving the cancer that we're currently seeing.
You know, the FDA does allow a certain level, certain percentage of DNA in normal vaccines. This is different type of DNA, though, correct?
That's a very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. So those regulations were written when vaccines were grown in eggs and in other cell cultures, where the contaminating DNA was genomic DNA of the cell line that was present in the vector of the host. This is very high copy number DNA of a gene therapy vector, which has these nuclear targeting sequences and has DNA in it that replicates inside of a mammalian cell. So when it gets into the cell, it can make more of itself. That's a very different contamination than what they considered when they wrote those 10 nanogram regulations. They also wrote those 10 nanogram regulations under the pretense of a 10-minute half-life of naked DNA in the blood, and we now have that DNA protected in lipid nanoparticles. And, of course, they have raised those guidelines over the last decade 1,000-fold. So we've really come to, I think, the end of the road of how much DNA we can tolerate, considering the tools we have to monitor and measure this have never been faster, better, or cheaper.
You mentioned the term half-life. One thing I don't think we've brought up yet is how long this mRNA is lasting in the body. I mean, again, we were told, we assumed that this was going to stay in the arm and be dissolved because mRNA is just so delicate that it was going to be, you know, not present in the body past a couple of days. But now we have studies that it's been in the body for at least 2 months, and we haven't studied beyond that, correct?
Yes.
Can you just address that, and is that have a component in this DNA contamination?
It does. So many of the studies that are looking at this, I'll name a few. Krausen et al. Looked at this in the heart and found it 30 days out in the heart. Hanna et al. Found this in breast milk. I think they went out a week on that study. Castriuda looked at this in plasma. It was out 28 days. And I think outside of that, we're recently seeing it in pregnant women inside of placenta, which is a real serious concern. Many of those studies do not differentiate between RNA or DNA, so it could be a combination of both of these things that are contributing to that signal. But DNA is certainly more stable than RNA. They have made modifications to this RNA that makes it last longer, but I think the verdict is still out as to which one has more longevity.
Again, thank you, Mr. McKernan. Our next...
Tell you what, we're going to pause right there because we're just seconds from the break. We just heard from Kevin McKernan from the former team leader with the Human Genome Project. The Genome Project, of course, and mapping out, it talked about this being a different type of DNA and its impact upon cancers here as well. And we have seen stories about the rash of cancer diagnoses that have come out since the COVID shot. Also how this is staying in the body, finding the mRNA in the breast milk of women who have been vaccinated as well as in their placenta. And so a warning there. And of course, this is information that is not being given out by the legacy media today or by various health organizations. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and Ron Johnson will be introducing the next guest, Dr. David Gortler. Back in 1 minute, you're listening to Crosstalk on the VCY American Network.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, scientist with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, how fast do stars change from one type of star into another?
Chris, evolutionists are fond of saying that changes in stars take millions of years to occur. But it's important to remember that they've never seen stars do anything for millions of years. And yet sometimes we do see stars undergo dramatic change quickly. Recently, a star was observed to change in only a few years from a white dwarf star about the size of the Earth to a giant star 80 times wider than the Sun, an increase in volume of over 500 million. Evolutionists used to insist that such changes took long periods, but when we see it happen rapidly. Evidently, the biblical doctrine of recent creation of all things is accurate. Back to Genesis, that's the view that fits the facts.
For more on Genesis, visit our website at icr.org. This is Chris O'Brien. Thanks for going back to Genesis.
This is Crosstalk coming your way from VCY America, and today we're airing from a roundtable that was happening last Monday. The federal health agencies and the COVID cartel, what are they hiding? Today is part two. We're going to be doing this in a three-part series, so we still will not get all of the audio in. Certainly will be representative of the types of information that had been given at this roundtable. You can go to Senator Johnson's website, finding links to the entire 4 hours, and to share it with others. Certainly can share links of the Crosstalk program with others as well. But right now we're going to continue on as Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin just ready to introduce his next guest.
Next participant is Dr. David Gortler. Dr. Gortler is the former senior advisor to the FDA commissioner, a former career FDA medical officer, and former professional of pharmacology at the Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Gortler.
Thank you, Senator. So if my slides could be displayed, there we go. So I'm going to be focusing my time talking about ingredient transparency. Federal rules requiring ingredient transparency date all the way back, believe it or not, to 1862. It's the whole reason the FDA was started in 1906 with the Pure Food and Drug Act. Prior to COVID RNA injections, the FDA had approved 4 different RNA-based products. Onpattro, shown here, was the first RNA product approved back in 2018. So as you can see by looking at this label, Onpattro prominently details the exact structure, milligram strength, and molecular weight. Highlighted in green at the very top, you'll see it specifies lipid nanoparticles are engineered for, quote, delivery to hepatocytes. Although macrolipid preparations are nothing new to pharmacology, lipid nanoparticles are quite new. In fact, the entire combination of nanotechnology with medicine is something which is extremely new. Even though the writing is small, you can still see all FDA-approved RNA drugs all specify fundamentals like molecular weight, and you can see the structure. This way, providers know exactly what they're giving, and consumers know exactly what they are getting. Next slide. This is just a brief slide to show that detailed structures are routinely and consistently provided across the board in FDA labeling. The FDA labeling, also referred to as the package insert, is the owner's manual and is the ultimate authority for what is contained in the drug. Every FDA-approved drug has one. Also routinely specified are the discrete specifications of which are the active versus inactive ingredients. Having ingredient specificity is important not only for consumers, but also for researchers who may analyze ingredients in the list against the contents. Verified structures can also potentially allow pharmacologists to use computers or cells or tissues in the laboratory to scientifically model what a drug could do. The next slide. So in contrast to the previous labels I've shown, here is the official FDA label for COVID RNA injections. As you can see, just looking at it, it details a lot less information. We don't have the structure. We don't have the molecular weight, et cetera. Although both drugs do specify a dose of 30 micrograms for Pfizer and 50 micrograms for Moderna, we don't know why those doses are different if they're supposedly encoding the same thing, which is the sequence for the spike protein. Regarding the lipid nanoparticle doses, it does specify that there are a total of 4 different lipid nanoparticles used, but it's unclear if they are either active or the inactive ingredients. We also don't have evidence of anything talking about the standalone safety of lipid nanoparticles, nor do we know the structures, the concentration, or the dose. The lack of transparency means that scientists can't use modeling to test the lipid nanoparticles for safety receptor specificity or analyze inequality. Of note, in pharmacology, even very minor deviations in any molecular structure can mean the difference between a drug and a poison. Next slide. Small molecule drugs can be analyzed very easily for purity, but complex molecules like COVID RNA drugs and its high-tech lipid nanoparticles need specific validated processes of how they're supposed to be checked. Unfortunately, around 70% of the 127-page document that explains the methodology to perform quality control on RNA injections are redacted, much like the document I'm shown here. The B4 annotations you see in the gray areas, they are there too, according to the FDA's website, quote, protect trade secrets and confidential commercial or financial information. Now, I've got no problem calling out the FDA when I think they're wrong, but to be exact, I don't know if it's the FDA who's at fault here. I don't know if the FDA was just a little bit over-caffeinated when it came to making redactions, or if there was some sort of codicil within the PREP Act that broadly gave manufacturers confidentiality to redact whatever they want. So to answer your question, Senator, the title of this meeting, I don't know where they're hiding, and I don't know if it's the manufacturers or the FDA, but I'm inclined to say that it's actually the manufacturers. The critical question is, though, should even a single word be redacted if it's funded with billions of taxpayer dollars? And that brings me to my next and final slide. Drug safety and ingredient transparency are inherently nonpartisan, non-political notions. Unfortunately, Democrats and Republicans don't agree on much these days, but both the Trump and the Biden White Houses have called for transparency on COVID shots. The question is, why do we even need to ask for it? How can ethical physicians and pharmacists continue to administer and promote these injections without a full disclosure of what the ingredients are? On top of all that, manufacturers were funded with billions of taxpayer dollars, including Moderna and Pfizer/NBiotech. Since taxpayers funded the private for-profit research, why don't we have 100% transparency on what we paid for? Thank you, Senator Johnson, for letting me be part of the panel, and Nina Schaefer and Roger Severino at the Heritage Foundation for the opportunity to present here today. These opinions are my own. I also want to thank Jeffrey Tucker of the Brownstone Institute for courageously publishing my articles on COVID when few others would.
Well, thank you, Dr. Gorler. As a former FDA employee, you seem, I think justifiably so, pretty outraged by what your former agency is doing here. Can you just kind of describe your feelings from that standpoint?
All we're asking for, my area of study, what I've dedicated the last 20 years of my life to, is drug safety. And all we're really asking for is just more specificity of what the ingredients are, what's considered an active ingredient, what's considered an inactive ingredient, nothing more. This is completely non-political. So everybody wants safe drugs.
So why do you think the FDA is leaving out this important information that they require for every other RNA drug?
Well, I'm not, like I said, I have no problem calling out the FDA when I think they've done something wrong, but it's not 100% clear if it's the FDA that just overdid it with the redactions or if it was something that was required by the PREP Act, if there was some sort of confidentiality. But the problem is, if the taxpayers had funded it, I think there should be, especially because we funded for-profit companies to be able to manufacture this, I think there should be, I think we should have full transparency, especially of the ingredients at the very, very minimum.
The one chart you had where you showed the redactions looked an awful lot like Fauci emails to me. But again, my assumption is that the FDA's primary role is to protect the public, not Big Pharma. Do you want to comment?
I understand how some documents have to be redacted. There's some stuff that goes on with the Pentagon and the military, which I don't know about, and we don't have to know about. But when it comes to medicines that we take, and in some cases medications that were mandated that we take, I don't think there should be any redaction.
They're protected by patents. Why not provide the information?
Because we paid for it. Exactly.
You mentioned lipid nanoparticles. Expand on that a little bit more.
So the lipid nanoparticles, I would refer to Robert Malone to talk more about that, but they're an essential component of it, but they're also a cutting edge, something which are a brand new area of pharmacology. The mixture of nanotechnology and medicine is something which is relatively brand new. And nanoparticles act differently in the body than simple small molecule pharmacology. Because of their nano size, which translates to 100 millionth of 1 millimeter, that defines a nanoparticle. I don't know if they can be detected, and of course we don't know if there's only a small change in the structure in the sequence, which we don't have. It can be the difference between something which is toxic and something which is non-toxic. Just for an example, there's one drug out there, a drug called tetracycline, which every pharmacist and every physician has ever heard of. It has a molecular weight of about 480 daltons, grams per mole. If you make one change to that, if you redact one, if you let it dry out and one OH group is removed from tetracycline, it becomes toxic. It turns into anhydrotetracycline or epianhydrotetracycline, and it completely changes it from a fully therapeutic drug to something which can cause Fanconi syndrome and kidney failure. Now, I mentioned it was about 400 daltons, which probably doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people here, but the size of just the sequence, not getting into the lipid nanoparticles, the sequence for RNA is somewhere between 1,000 or 6,000 times that size. And I don't know, because I don't know what the exact sequence is, because it's not listed in the label.
So it's my understanding that the lipid nanoparticle was designed to permeate, difficult to permeate barriers. That kind of goes back to the lies we were all told, that this injection was going to stay in the arm, be destroyed very quickly once it produced the antibodies, and everything's going to be just fine. But the fact that they knew that they were using a carrier that was designed to permeate difficult, like the blood-brain barrier, like the placental barrier, is that part of your concern here?
Well, but part of the concern is also, to answer your question briefly, yes. And because we know for Onpro and other RNA-type drugs, some of those lipid nanoparticles were tuned. They were specially engineered to enter hepatocytes. But we don't know, because we don't know the structure and we don't know the tuning of these lipid nanoparticles, and we don't know if there's any standalone safety with them, we don't know if they were specially tuned to enter hepatocytes or cardiac tissue or brain tissue or uterine tissue or any of those areas.
And the bottom line, the pharma company should have known, and certainly the American public should know. And none of those things may be true. So thank you, Dr. Gortler.
Thank you.
Our next participant is Dr. Harvey Risch. Dr. Risch is a professor emeritus of epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health and an outspoken proponent of early COVID treatment and critical and objective scientific thought throughout the pandemic. Dr. Risch.
Well, thank you, Senator. I'm talking today about what I consider the crushingly obsessive push to COVID vaccinate every living person on the planet. So we all know, circumstantially at least, that the virus that leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology in fall 2019, the initial cases paralleled the Wuhan subway line 2, which passes by the WIV. The virus contains a unique 19-nucleotide genetic sequence that also exists in Moderna patents from 2017, and various other biological and spy intelligence information, evidence that overwhelmingly implicates the WIV as the source of the leak. So this virus, the COVID-19 pandemic virus, exists because it was bioengineered. The WIV scientists used Ralph Baric's genetic manipulation.
We're going to pause right there. He said it was bioengineered, and we're just up against a break, and I want to continue with this thought right afterwards. You're listening to Crosstalk on BCY America as we are airing excerpts from the federal, it was a roundtable discussion, federal health agencies and the COVID cartel. What are they hiding? We're going to continue hearing from Dr. Harvey Risch right after the break. You're listening to Crosstalk on the BCY America Network.
Year after year, generation after generation, we as Americans enjoy the right and opportunity to let our voices be heard through the election of our governing officials. With over 200 years of peaceful transition from one elected body to another, the stability of America's republic stands alone among nations. Our founders pledged their life, their fortune, and their sacred honor in the establishment of this nation. Our country's founding documents have guided this nation and are the substance by which today's laws are judged. Do you own a copy of the Constitution? Documents of Freedom is a pocket-sized booklet containing the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and all other amendments passed.
The booklet also features the Declaration of Independence and Washington's Farewell. Documents of Freedom is available for a donation of $5 or more to VCY America and can be made by calling 1-800-729-9829. That's 1-800-729-9829.
This is Crosstalk coming your way from the VCY American Network and airing from a roundtable that was held last week Monday. Federal health agencies and the COVID cartel, what are they hiding? Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin hosted this at the United States Capitol, and I've heard from a couple individuals today. We're going back to Dr. Harvey Risch, but also in this segment, we're going to be hearing from Barbara Lowe Fisher, who's been a guest multiple times here on Crosstalk programs. And some of you listening right now say, why does all of this matter? Why is this important? Well, friends, because the actions that were taken during the COVID outbreak are measures like we've never seen before in our country. The heavy-handed control to force individuals to stay in their home or to stand inside a circle 6 feet from other individuals. The classification of which businesses were essential, which ones were not. I mean, we even had states that were indicating which aisles in the store were essential aisles and which aisles had to be blocked off. Seriously, folks, in some stores, you were not able to go down certain aisles because in that aisle were not products that were considered to be, quote, essential. Now, keep in mind also that there is planning and preparations that are going on right now for what's being called Disease X. We're told it's not a matter of if, but when. We're also told disease X could be 20 times deadlier than COVID. So what lengths will they go to in order to, quote, protect us from this disease X? And friends, also keep in mind that the World Health Organization right now, in cooperation with nations from around the world, have been drafting the international health regulations to culminate at the 77th World Health Assembly, May 27th through June 1st of this year, looking for countries around the world to sign on that will give the World Health Organization designees ultimate power and control over your health and your healthcare decisions. That's why we're airing this here today, to open the eyes of the American public up. Legacy media is not doing it, folks. Big Pharma does not want you to hear this information. That Ron Johnson has many times asked the heads of Moderna and Pfizer to come and speak at these roundtables and discussion sessions that he's had. They never take him up on it. I wonder why. So we're going to continue right now with the audio. This is Dr. Harvey Risch, and also we'll be introduced to Barbara Lowe Fisher this segment as well. Let's continue on.
This virus, the COVID-19 pandemic virus, exists because it was bioengineered. The WIB scientists used Ralph Baric's genetic manipulation techniques, technology, at their insecure BSL-2 lab. So this was reckless work at the WIB that was funded by NIH through the Dash Act EcoHealth Alliance money laundry, as well as by large DOD and USAID grants. Now, this work and the WIV leak was what I consider to be the fruit of our bioweapons industry that has been performing secretive and nefarious biological weapons development for the last 70 years. The recognition of the possible accidental or intentional unleashing of an infectious agent capable of killing large numbers of humanity led to the Bioweapons Treaty of 1975 that President Ford signed. The treaty prohibits the development of offensive bioweapons. However, the one loophole in the treaty is that small quantities of offensive bioweapons are allowed to be developed in order to do research on vaccine countermeasures. Now, this loophole was then exploited by our bioweapons industry for the last 50 years. The bioweapons treaty limited offensive bioweapons to agents that would address vaccine development, so-called dual-use agents or dual-use research. And this was the premise and motivation of the various virology grant applications like Diffuse and so on submitted to DOD and NIH funders. This was the permitted rationale for the development of offensive bioweapons in that it would lead to work on vaccine countermeasures. Now fast forward to 2019. Many billions of dollars spent on the bioweapons industry over the past decades for all of this work on offensive bioweapons. Where are the successful commercial vaccines to show for it? So there's been lots of vaccine research that's been carried out for known harmful organisms, but minimally, if at all, for these gain-of-function bioweapons agents. And for COVID, it took a year of shoddy research to produce and test the first batch of commercial vaccines for SARS-CoV-2. And how is a year delay even remotely acceptable for a military defense against a bioweapon that spreads across populations in weeks? A year to develop a vaccine that for pandemics that occur in waves in weeks. And these vaccines are supposed to be deployed before a pandemic occurs, not in the middle of one. So my hypothesis, what I believe, is that both the virus origin cover-up and the forced vaccination of the entire planet were orchestrated to protect the integrity of the bioweapons industry. Once the general public understood the reckless and cavalier behavior of this industry that had operated under a false and misrepresented pretense of vaccine development that has never been successfully commercially realized, it would then clamor to shut down the industry. And so the suppression of knowledge of the industry's reckless involvement in the Wuhan leak is an obvious cover-up. And we have proof of that cover-up from the FOIA documents involving Fauci, Collins, Jeremy Ferrara, and others. And my conclusion, then, is the reason why the whole population had to be vaccinated is to show that the bioweapons industry supposedly did have a rationale of vaccine development as part of its claimed dual-use research. The vaccines, then, are the evidence that the bioweapons industry was properly justified from the beginning. Without a successful vaccine to show for itself in the time of a pandemic crisis, especially one caused by a leak from a bioweapons industry source itself, it would be clear to everyone that the rationale for the industry's existence was a fraud in the first place. And so the COVID vaccines themselves supplied the defense against the charge that the bioweapons industry was not actually dual use, but offensive only, violating the 1975 treaty. So the vaccines had to be dramatically pushed out to be the universal solution to show that the bioweapons industry was actually working for the public good. And in this context, it did not matter what collateral damage the vaccines caused. All there had to be was the public thinking, public thought of this theater, that the industry had been doing its worst work to produce usable vaccines, not offensive bioweapons.
Well, thank you, Dr. Risch. So the rationale, of course, of the bio industry there is that if others are developing bioweapons, don't we need countermeasures? In order to develop the countermeasures, we need to create a limited quantity of bioweapons. I mean, can you just address that justification?
Well, this goes to my sarcastic comment about disproportionality, that from a military perspective, if one is attacked by a bioweapons agent, then why would one have to respond with a bioweapons agent? One could respond with economic warfare, conventional weapons, chemical weapons, nuclear weapons, if it was that bad, that we have at our disposal a whole range of responses. And to launch an untested bioweapon as a response, where we might not even be able to protect ourselves from blowback from that agent, it's, to me, is insane, that there's no rational reason.
There's a very interesting chart in Robert F. Kennedy's new book, The Wuhan Cover-Up. And, you know, we were all, and I've talked about Fauci's emails where he funded Peter Daszak's Eco-Health Alliance to the tune of about $15-16 million. What I did not realize is the Department of Defense funded Eco-Health Alliance to the tune of $42 million, and USAID, which RFK Jr. says is pretty much a CIA cutout, I don't dispute that, funded to the tune of $53.6 million. So it kind of confirms what you're talking about in terms of, you know, what the justification was. One of the countermeasures you didn't mention, but the way we met was in 2020, talking about early treatment. As an epidemiologist, can you talk about that fact? I mean, we relied everything on vaccines for the reasons that you've assumed. But just going along with that was the sabotage of early treatment.
Well, during the time of the suppression of early treatment, hydroxychloroquine and later ivermectin, I thought it was to protect the marketplace for the vaccines, other medications or the vaccines that would eventually come out. But now, given what I've said, I think the suppression was that if those medications solved the pandemic, then the vaccines wouldn't have been needed, and then the bioweapons treaty would come back in force, and there would be no rationale that the vaccines were the end product of the offensive bioweapons research. So they had to be suppressed for the same reason.
So again, you've come up with an assumption based on the fact that so much has happened hasn't made any sense whatsoever. And I've heard that time and time again from people, you know, fighting in the medical freedom movement. It's just like, this thing, none of this makes sense. So you have to start coming up with different theories.
That is true. I mean, I haven't been inside the room of anywhere where they told me all of this, but there's very little that makes sense. And you have to think, if you were doing this work and you know you're the CIA or you're the WHO or whoever has been pulling the puppet strings, that you're going to look really bad when stuff that you've done that is kind of nefarious but you've gotten away with it suddenly comes into public view, and now the public's saying, yeah, but we weren't supposed to be doing this in the first place, and look at the damage that this has caused because you couldn't contain it. You promised you would contain it at the worst, and you didn't contain it.
And you need to protect your $1 billion worth of grants and funding that you get every year as well. Okay.
That's right.
Well, thank you, Dr. Risch. Our next participant is Ms. Barbara Lowe Fisher. She is co-founder and president of the Charitable National Vaccine Information Center, established in 1982 by parents of vaccine-injured children. Ms. Fisher.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, for this opportunity to talk about how vaccine victims have been blamed, shamed, and betrayed over the years by doctors and scientists, paid by federal agencies and industries, and by some members of Congress, working especially since 2019 with political operatives and corporate media to silence anyone who criticizes vaccine science, policy, and law so the truth can be hidden and public conversations about vaccine risks and failures can be shut down. Today, everybody knows somebody who was healthy, got vaccinated, and was never healthy again. Of all developed nations in the world, America has the worst infant and maternal mortality rates and is home to the most highly vaccinated, but the sickest and most disabled child and young adult populations. That inconvenient truth, that failing public health report card bankrupting our nation, is central to what we are talking about here today. Demonization of and discrimination against those who decline to get a government-recommended vaccine or talk publicly about how they or a loved one were injured or died after vaccination has been going on since the 19th century. But what is happening in the 21st century in the name of disease control, national security, and the greater good is escalation of an historic denial of vaccine risks and failures that has become a dangerous assault on freedom of thought, speech, and conscience, and poses a grave threat to the biological integrity and natural rights of the people. It has been 44 years since my 2-year-old son was brain injured by his fourth DPT shot, and 42 years since I watched the Emmy Award-winning documentary DPT Vaccine Roulette, and then joined with other parents of pertussis vaccine-injured children to establish the charity known today as the National Vaccine Information Center at nvic.org.
We're going to pause right there. We'll continue with Barbara Lowe Fisher's testimony right after the break. We'll get right into it. We'll try and get a majority of what she had to say. This is Crosstalk on VCY America.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brandon House. Our website is worldviewreport.com. A few weeks ago, Mark Stein was ordered to pay $1 million for questioning climate change advocates. My friends, this, of course, is leading us right down the path of the continuation of the death of free speech. This is a case that went on for years and years. No telling how much money was spent litigating this in the courts, only for Mark Stein and one other co-defendant to lose. All they did was question the research of a climate change proponent. And in doing so, he now is going to receive $1 million. Christians, conservatives, anyone that expresses something outside the norm of cultural Marxism, the globalist agenda, political correctness, is now at risk of being sued into oblivion. And of course, what this does is freeze free speech.
Continuing with the roundtable, federal health agencies and the COVID cartel, what are they hiding? Part number two today, we go back to Barbara Lowe Fisher.
Our mission is to prevent vaccine injuries and deaths through public education. We do not make vaccine use recommendations. We defend the ethical principle of informed consent to medical risk-taking and the legal right for adults to make voluntary vaccine decisions for themselves and on behalf of their minor children without being coerced or punished for the decision made. I worked with parents in Congress to secure safety and informed consent provisions in the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986. It was an historic law, the first official acknowledgement by government that federally licensed and state-mandated vaccines can and do injure and kill some children. On January 4, 2024, my eyewitness perspective of how and why child vaccine victims and their parents were betrayed after that law was passed 38 years ago was featured in a two-hour conversation I had with Dale Bigtree on the High Wire. I encourage everyone to watch it and learn how parents trusted that the 5 years of work we put into that 1986 act to successfully secure life-saving informing, recording, reporting, and research provisions in it, and to protect the legal right of vaccine victims to sue vaccine manufacturers for product design defects and to sue negligent doctors for medical malpractice and to create an expedited, more just, less traumatic federal vaccine injury compensation system alternative to a lawsuit were all destroyed by congressional amendments by federal health agencies and the U.S. Supreme Court after that law was passed. Following that betrayal of trust, Congress directed federal agencies to create lucrative public-private business partnerships with the pharmaceutical industry, a business deal that has broken America's public health system. Legislation enacted in the 1990s and after September 11, 2001, laid the groundwork for the rise of a public health empire which is funded and operated by government and the wealthiest and most politically powerful individuals, corporations, and public and private institutions in the world. Now those operating that empire are threatening our legal right in this constitutional republic to exercise freedom of thought, speech, and conscience. Past is prologue. The betrayal of the public trust during the COVID pandemic could never have happened if many of the leaders we elected had not long ago abandoned rational thinking and succumbed to fear-based propaganda tactics, requiring us to give up the natural right to autonomy for an illusion of safety.
Thank you, Ms. Fisher. By the way, I became aware of you from that excellent documentary, which I would also recommend. What struck me about that documentary is, you know, back then, in 82 through 86, you could talk about these things. You could advocate for your child who was vaccine injured. You weren't ostracized. You were actually welcomed here in the Senate by people like Senator Hatch and Senator Kennedy. And you got this signed by Ronald Reagan under resistance. But can you just speak to what has changed in terms of the public attitude where there was public pressure to pass the bill that you shepherded through Congress to now where, again, I'm assuming you're not anti-vax. I mean, we all have to say that, but we're concerned about things. But just talk about the difference between then and now.
Yes. Well, you know, it's an entirely different situation today than it was back then. We had congressional hearings. We had dozens of congressional hearings in the House and the Senate on that 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. And the media covered it. They covered all of the aspects of what was going on. You know, I sat for more than 20 years as a consumer member on the vaccines advisory committees at the FDA, the CDC, and the Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Sciences. And this past summer, we have suffered such abuse and discrimination. And I.
So, again, just real quick, you were welcomed in serving on those panels back then.
Yes.
Now the elite, they are out to destroy you.
Yes. I mean, on November 1st, 2023, I submitted this report on censorship to the U.S. Judiciary Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. This report is anchored with over 400 live link references. It describes how officials at the highest levels of the Department of Health and Justice and Homeland Security, and even 17 members of the U.S. House of Representatives, asked PayPal to defund the National Vaccine Information Center. They worked with political operatives and corporate legacy and social media to silence my voice and other voices for talking online about vaccine reactions and the fact that people who get vaccinated can still get infected and transmit infection, which is true for the mRNA COVID vaccines, but it's also true for many of the 72 doses of 17 vaccines that the CDC now tells doctors to give to children starting on the first day of birth. And I believe because our organization, which really launched the Vaccine Safety and Informed Consent Movement in America in 1982, we lobbied for 14 years to get a less toxic, acellular pertussis vaccine in here to replace wholesale pertussis vaccine in 1996. And we lobbied to get the live polio vaccine that can cause vaccine-strain polio paralysis replaced by an inactivated vaccine that does not. And we have gone into the state legislatures, and we worked through our MVICAdvocacy.org portal to educate the states on protecting the flexible medical, religious, and conscience belief exemptions, which are integral to the true exercise of informed consent. And I think because of that, we have been ostracized. Our voice has been silenced. We were thrown off of Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter in the space of seven months in 2021. That was a censorship campaign that was condoned by the highest levels of government. And, you know, I never imagined when I began this work in 1982 that the day would come when I would not be able to exercise freedom of thought and conscience in the country I love. And I thank you for allowing me to exercise that right today.
It was not only condoned at the highest level of governments, it was orchestrated by.
Yes. Yes, it was.
The administration. It was orchestrated by. But thank you, Ms. Fisher.
Well, friends, we're going to stop there, picking up with this roundtable discussion again. This was held last week, Monday, February 26, 2024, at the U.S. Capitol, hosted by Senator Ron Johnson. The full 4 hours can be heard through Ron Johnson's website. But friends, keeping you informed, one more day coming up tomorrow here on Crosstalk. Thank you so much for joining us.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208, or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.